Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
Hello, fellow Rebel Capitalists. Hope you're well. Eager to dive into your questions today. Probably do about 30 minutes or so. I was out very, very late last night with the team, the editors, Adriana, Thomas, Stephanie, Danny, well, the whole team, the whole YouTube team. And we are out celebrating getting to 400,000 subscribers, which we'll probably do sometime tomorrow, something like that. So out late, having a good time here in Medellin, Colombia with the whole crew. Looking forward to getting to 500,000 and then who knows, maybe even a million subscribers soon. We'll see. Well, let's get into your questions here. What have we got for this evening? So where do you store your physical gold? Yeah, I mean, I like to store it. Whoops, I missed one. Okay. I like to store it as much as possible. With me. I don't know where my bag is. Oh, here it is. I got that. Oh, here's one. Here's one. So hopefully you get my point. I've got, travel with these things. They're given to me, so I just keep them in my bag. Well, actually, this one I was not given to me, but okay. Anyway, so bottom line here, I'm obviously kind of joking around a little bit, but and I won't show you the bag it was in, but I just like to keep as much as you feel comfortable, just kind of buried in the backyard. And then if you don't, you kind of store it. But also, I think the Sprott Trust is good. So PHYS, I've got, that's kind of the majority of what I've bought lately because I've just been traveling so much and I don't have a backyard to dig a hole and bury stuff in it. So anyway, yeah, I mean, as much as you feel comfortable keeping within walking distance, I think it's probably a good idea. But then if you don't like that, PHYS, if you don't like that, you know, I would, think about storing it somewhere in Singapore. I mean, there's hundreds of companies that do that. Okay, how successful will the ECB and Fed be with their new unlimited bond buying tool when they lose control of the debt markets? I don't know. I don't know that they lose. You know, obviously there's a point in time where they do lose control of the bond market, but it seems like we're quite a ways. And the reason I say this is because I hear kind of talking heads say all the time, oh my gosh, well, the Fed is going to have to monetize the debt. They're going to have to monetize the debt. They're going to have to monetize the debt, as if there's just zero demand for treasuries. But I don't know that the treasury market is telling us that. I mean, the Fed's not buying treasuries right now. And I get it. They've got a lot on their balance sheet. But when Janet Yellen does an auction, the Fed isn't showing up. So whoever is showing up and buying the bonds right now, they're willing to take basically 2.9% on 10-year. Okay, so that's not the Fed. So by stating that they're going to lose control of the debt markets, that means that interest rates are just going to skyrocket and bond prices are going to just crash because there's no buyers, there's no bid. And maybe with corporate debt, you see that potentially happening. But I think what you're referring to, what most people refer to when they talk about losing control, is the treasury market. And again, I understand that there's a point in time when we get there, but I think we're a long way right now because it seems to me like there's plenty of demand for treasuries outside of the Fed. So I guess my point here is I don't know that they'll have to come in and monetize the debt to keep interest rates low. I don't know that they'll have to continue quantitative easing. And even if they did, I don't know that it's highly inflationary, because if QE is highly inflationary, what happened 2008 to 2020? What happened in Japan? So I guess what I'm saying is, under certain conditions, sure, QE might be, I don't know I'd even go that far. QE in and of itself is not inflationary. QE combined with massive fiscal deficit spending can be inflationary. And it's a very nuanced question, right? Because you got to think about the process. So what happens when the Fed does quantitative easing is they just buy treasuries from primary dealers. Okay. So, and most likely these primary dealers are just using bank reserves, because let's just assume it's a primary dealer operation for JP Morgan or something. So JP Morgan is just going out and buying the treasuries. Okay. Well, who are they buying them from? And this is the primary dealer to sell to the Fed. Okay. Well, let's just assume they're buying it from Goldman Sachs. Okay. That's just all bank reserve. That's all just Fed balance sheet operations. That's it. Now, if that primary dealer buys from Average Joe, then what happens? Then the Average Joe trades his treasury for $1,000, let's say. So then the Average Joe now has $1,000 in his bank account that he did not have prior to that. So that increases the dollars circulating, chasing goods and services. But if the primary dealer bought the treasury from Goldman Sachs, that's the increase in M2 money supply occurred when Goldman Sachs bought the treasury from the Average Joe. See, this is where people, they kind of gloss over it. And because I think they hear it said so often and they don't get down into the nitty gritty and the nuance. And I think that in order to make a prediction or to assess probabilities of certain events occurring, such as inflation and deflation, you've got to get into the weeds a little bit and just not just say, okay, is it fiscal and is it QE, but what's the next layer of complexity? And I think by knowing that additional layer, or maybe multiple layers, it'll increase your efficiency in predicting probabilities of inflation, deflation, disinflation. So I know that was a long-winded answer, but that's something that I see people all the time in the mainstream media, in the financial media, just say as kind of like a flippant remark, and as though it's all obviously true, and it may or may not be. I guess that's my point. Moving from Columbia to Philadelphia, oh my gosh, you've got to be kidding me. You're moving from Columbia to Philadelphia? What on earth would possess you to do such a thing? And I say that because obviously Columbia is one of my favorite, if not my favorite place on earth. And Philadelphia would be right up there with my least favorite. Maybe certain parts of Manila in the Philippines, right up there as well. What, maybe Baltimore, DC, probably my least favorite. Anyway. So with the COP at 4.4 and all my savings in COP, should I buy dollars and buy an apartment in Philly, or is it better? I don't know, man. Just how about not move to Philly and stay in Columbia, where the food's incredible, the weather's amazing, the people are great. Why you would want to move to Philadelphia, a crime-ridden, I'm not going to use a Trump term, but wow. I just think you should not go to Philadelphia, and then you don't have to worry about figuring out what to do with your pesos. There you go. No, seriously, let me try to answer your question here. What should you do by dollars? I mean, I wouldn't buy an apartment in Philly. Again, are you buying low, selling high, or are you buying high and selling low, right? My guess is that apartment in Philly, or the real estate in Philly, is probably at all-time highs. I don't like buying that. I mean, your savings in COP dollars, if you're going to live in the United States, again, I don't know why you would, but if you're going to choose to live there, then your expenses are going to be in dollars. Therefore, it's probably wise to have your savings in dollars. I mean, that goes for anybody. I shouldn't say that, though, because if I was in Turkey, I would not want my savings in Turkish lira, even though my expenses were. So I take that back. But yeah, so at some point, you're probably going to want to turn your savings into dollars. Can you have Harry? I don't know who that is. What do we have to do to get more of these pragmatic Gen Xers into public office? I have more hope. Yeah. I mean, whenever people say stuff, I mean, I get it why people say stuff like that, but to me, the solution isn't getting the right person in office. That's, even if it does solve a problem, I think it's just temporary. For me, the solution is just reduce the size of government. Because if you reduce the size of government, you will get the good people you want. So why? Because the type of people we want are just your stereotypical public servant, the benevolent public servant. And those are people that are going to be drawn to smaller government, or those are the types of people I think that would fill those positions. Because when government gets bigger and bigger and bigger, it attracts more sociopaths. It attracts bigger and bigger megalomaniacs. And the sociopaths always win the elections. They beat all of the good people. Why? Because the way you win an election is you have to be the biggest liar. So whoever lies and the most, whoever has just zero ethics, has no moral North Star, is willing just to say whatever people want to hear to buy the vote, stab people in the back. I mean, it's just goes straight back to Machiavelli. Whoever is willing to do what Machiavelli outlines in The Prince is going to be the person that most likely wins the election, or usually wins. Okay, well, those people are going to be drawn to power. So if the more powerful the government is, the more it's going to attract the Machiavellian types. And they're going to beat the trustworthy types, because, again, that's how you win an election. And so it's completely perverse with our system. Is the way the elections are set up, it's the worst person wins, not the best, usually. So, again, my longer-term solution would be reduce the size of government. That's where our focus should be, not just temporarily getting the right person in the job. What books would you suggest? It says, what books would you suggest to brush up on speaking Mandarin? Okay. Have considered reaching out to Benioff or Schwab for an interview? No, but I would, I don't know if I'd interview. Benioff is just, I don't know if I could tolerate Benioff. He is so slimy, isn't he? I mean, he's like Gavin Newsom or like Trudeau. You know what I'm talking about? Maybe slimy is not the right, maybe it is the right word. Yeah, I think that is the right word, where they just talk and they just ooze disingenuousness, if that's a word. But they're just so phony and so plastic and just, I can't stand it. So, Klaus doesn't seem as slimy. I mean, he's probably, who knows, he's probably evil, or maybe he's not. Maybe he's just, maybe he truly does have good intentions, and maybe he's just like a do-gooder where he has good intentions, but so do the socialists and the communists, some of them. You know, they have good intentions, but holy cow, their solutions are just completely devastating for society and the global economy. But, you know, I always try to give people the benefit of the doubt, but my base case is that he's a Machiavellian type. To an extreme. But I'd love to talk to him. Absolutely. Yeah, I'm not one of those people that, oh, I'm not going to talk to that person just, out of principle. I would never even, no, I'll talk to anybody if I think I can learn something, even if I might not agree with them, or I might not, we might not see eye to eye, or I might not think that they're morally upright, or they share my worldview, or maybe my what I would consider ethical standards. But if I can learn from him, my goodness gracious, don't you think we could all learn from having me or another great interviewer like Eric Townsend, as an example, interview Klaus Schwab? I mean, I think that would be fantastic. Yeah, I'd love to do it. Now, my guess is the feeling would not be mutual with Klaus. because whereas I like to talk to everyone, especially people I do not agree with, I think the Klaus types are the complete opposite of that. They do not like to talk to anybody, and they like to control speech and disinformation and misinformation. Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options. Tony Greer, commodity trading. Jason Hartman, real estate. And Brent Johnson with macroeconomics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out of control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow Rebel Capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level. All right. What is the probability the Fed reverse course and inflation continues to the moon? I think pretty high. That's kind of my base case. So probably you guys know I've heard this, or I've said this a million times on the channel. I think Q3, Q4, you get some disinflation. And then if we're in a recession, most likely we will be. And but there are no certainties, only probabilities. And then we just get the same routine. We get the stimmy checks. It just seems like every single time that we go into a financial crisis or a recession, that they just do more of what they did the last time. And now you could argue that this time may be a little bit different because we could have an extreme, even though we have disinflation, relatively speaking, we could have high in CPI print, 4 or 5%. That would be disinflation, but that's still high. And, I was listening to my good buddy, Adam Taggart, who, by the way, is another fantastic interviewer. If you guys aren't listening to the Wealthion podcast, I'd suggest doing so. But he interviewed my good buddy, Jeff Snyder, and it's a fantastic conversation. But they brought up a very good point. They said, if you're a politician, what is worse for your polling numbers? Or for the polls, a recession or inflation? It's like tied, right? I mean, which is worse as far as being political kryptonite? And Adam said, well, we'll probably find out. And yeah, we probably will. So if we get down to 5% inflation and we're going through a pretty difficult recession, I think the politicians have to make a choice. Do you deficit spend, do CARES Act 2.0, and risk stoking inflation if the constituency and the voting population is still super, super pissed off that inflation is already high? Or have they kind of forgotten about inflation being very high, or they've gotten used to it and they're complaining more about the recession? And then you do the stimulus. You see how I think that's kind of what the choice is going to be in 2023. Blockworks Macro had a podcast on the future of oil prices. I don't think that's a question. Sounds like a statement. What are your cash flowing single family residents? I assume you're saying, Joey, with all the cash instead of leverage due to the geopolitical climate, I'm middle class peasant trying to get out of the rat race. It's not my favorite, Joey, because housing prices are at all time highs. I mean, if you're an expert and you can, if you're like a Jason Hartman, and you know, like the really good markets, the linear markets, you can get a good positive cash flow, 30-year fixed rate debt, I'd consider it, but just understand that you're playing with fire. And if your objective is to, or if your sole objective or number one priority is to increase your capital gain by the house appreciating, that's, I think, going to be dangerous. If your only goal is just positive cash flow and you're happy to keep the house for the next 30 years or never sell the house, and you're an expert, then I would consider it. But again, proceed with caution, understanding that you are buying a house when the prices are at all time highs adjusted for inflation. and they are way above the, I'm going to say, healthy natural trend line going back to 1900. And this trend line is important because it reflects the price to income ratio. And the incomes are here, and the prices are obviously much, 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 much higher than they ever have been historically. And that's you know, we want to buy low and sell high. We don't want to buy high and try to sell higher. And so again, if it's strictly cash flow, maybe if you're looking for capital appreciation, I don't know. But then, you know, if you're kind of just trying to, with the exception of a triplex, because I think that's like, especially if you're a young person, like in your mid-20s or something, I think that's such a smart move. Even in today's environment, I think that still might be a smart move if it's in one of these linear markets and if it's positive cash flow, just so your renters are, I mean, even if the price got cut in half of the house, who cares, right? Because your renters are still paying your mortgage payment, your rent. So then that's your number one expense as a young person. So if you can eliminate that and take that money that would have gone to rent or your mortgage payment and allocate that to building a portfolio, boy, that's a smart financial move. So you see what I'm saying? It's not just a blanket statement like now is a bad time to buy or a good time to buy. It really depends on your objectives and kind of you know, where you are in life and what type of single family resident you're buying. Well, I guess that was stupid, wasn't it? Because I guess a triplex wouldn't really be considered single family. it was a long night, guys. Oh boy. At least I showed up, right? Oh, I'm trying to find another question here. All right. We are in an invisible depression where a lot of the population and the assistance supported by taxation. How do you see this playing out over the next couple of years in California? We're already seeing a reduction in promised raises for Yeah, Terry. I mean, it's a great question, and unfortunately I think the standard of living in the United States is going to deteriorate in aggregate total. I mean, I think it has significantly over the last, say, 5 years. I've noticed a big change when I go to the States. You know, unfortunately what has happened is we as Americans we've lived above our means. We've consumed far more than we've produced over the past 40 years, for heaven's sakes. So at some point in time, those chickens come home to roost. And then you go through a phase where just think about if asset prices got cut in half, housing market down 50% in nominal terms, stock market down 50% in nominal terms, then we would see Americans in aggregate total living, they'd still be probably living above their means to a certain degree, because the dollar, the reserve currency, and yada, yada, you know, artificially low interest rates. But it would be more in alignment, I think, is a good way to look at it. And unfortunately, though, now this may not be the case in the next couple of years, but over the next couple decades, we're going to get to a point where Americans actually have to produce more than they consume. And that's going to be a very, very tough time. Very, very, very tough time. So, I mean, my advice would be, you know, California is not the place to be. My goodness, if I was in the United States, I'd obviously go Texas, Florida, something like that. I think that you're only going to get a further and further bifurcation in California. You know, what's interesting about Medellin and Colombia is it is true. You've got quite an extreme between rich and poor. I mean, you've got the same extreme in the United States, but you've got far more people part of the middle class. And the difference is Colombia has a growing middle class, where the United States has a shrinking middle class, even though the United States, as of right now, if we just froze things as they are, has a higher percentage in the middle class. You see what I'm saying? So, I mean, it sounds crazy to say this, but I think that, well, I don't know if I'd go that far, because a lot of times I say that if the United States, if Americans had to produce actually more than they consume, you're looking at the standard of living very similar to Mexico. And I don't know that I'd go that far, but probably what you would do, you would see the standard of living across the United States maybe similar to what it is in maybe a very poor, I don't know if I'd go so far as to say Mexico, but maybe like a Mississippi or Puerto Rico or, you know, something like that. What are your thoughts on ECB latest unlimited bond buying tool? Oh, okay, yeah, I think we talked about that. Oh, no, we didn't, because you're talking about defragmentation of the Eurozone. I don't know how long. I think they've done a great job keeping it together, if that's your only objective. But I don't know how long they can keep playing this game, because if I'm the Germans, I mean, how pissed off would you be? I mean, really, you're going to do Operation Twist, where you jack up the interest rates in Germany or try to subsidize the interest rates in Italy? I mean, at a certain point, the Germans just have to say, no, this is madness. This is crazy. You know what's interesting about that situation is Germany is in a very similar position to the United States in this, and if you're looking at it through the lens of Triffin's paradox, right? Or Triffin's dilemma. In fact, I've never actually really thought about that. Maybe I should do a whiteboard. Because Triffin's dilemma basically is whichever sovereign has the world reserve currency is going to have to make a choice. Either you do what's right for your country or you do what's right for the world at the expense of your country. And then vice versa. You know, either you do what's right for your country at the expense of the world. And Germany is pretty much in the same spot, right? Do you do what's right for Europe at the expense of your own people, or do you do what's right for your own people at the expense of Europe? I think that's kind of the corner they've painted themselves into. And I don't know how it stays together. I'm sure there's a way, but I think especially over the next 10, 20 years, I would say my base case is that it defragments, that they cannot prevent it from defragmenting, because of at a certain point, you know, the Germans just are going to say enough. Maybe we would be at that point sooner than later, but I think maybe what's going on with the Russian gas is such a huge problem that maybe that's got everyone's attention, and this, you know, subsidizing the southern countries is kind of on the back burner right now. I don't know. I'm not in Germany, but I think at some point in time, they're going to have to make that decision. Thoughts on nuclear restarts in Japan? Yeah, makes sense. I mean, absolutely makes sense. This is one of the reasons I'm so bullish on uranium long term, and can't wait to buy it cheaper. So I think we're in a commodity bull cycle, super cycle, that will last till 2030, 2035. So, you know, I don't want a recession for obvious reasons, but if we're going to get one, then I'm like Jim Rogers says, I hope I'm smart enough to buy those commodities like uranium when and if the price goes lower. Are government salaries money printing? I mean, not really. You got to take it a step back. So how is the government getting the money? They're selling the treasuries. Okay, so who's buying the treasuries? So let's just assume for a moment it's the average Joe. So the average Joe takes the $100 in his bank account, let's just say, and he says, okay, I'd prefer to have this treasury over the $100 in my bank account. So his balance sheet, the $100 is removed, and he gets a treasury. So what happens to the amount of dollars in the system? Shrinks, right? Goes down by $100, whatever you want to call it, M2 or commercial bank liabilities, you know, deposit liabilities. So it goes down by $100. Okay. So what happens? All right. Well, the bank reserves that from, let's just say, average Joe Banks with Wells Fargo, $100 of bank reserves would go from Wells Fargo's account at the Fed down into the TGA, the Treasury General account. So the Treasury General account now has $100 in bank reserves that they received as a result of selling the treasury that the average Joe now has on his balance sheet. Okay, cool. Then what does the TGA do? Then the TGA basically writes a check to the average Jane, let's say, for STEMI or something. And the average Jane takes that government spending and takes the check, deposits it at Bank of America, and her in her account increases by $100. And then those bank reserves go from the TGA to Bank of America because they have a new $100 liability. That's the check that average Jane cashed or deposited. And then they have those bank reserves that went from the TGA, the Treasury General account, to their account at the Fed. That's the asset to back up the liability. So what has happened? We've gone full circle, right? Basically, what has happened is the average Joe's account went down by $100 and the average Jane's account went up by $100. So on net balance, we have the same amount of currency units chasing goods and services. Got it? So then if a bank were to buy the treasury directly from Janet Yellen, then when the TGA spends that money, it's new money that's being created. It increases M2 money supply. See, so that's again why this nuance is so incredibly important, right? So going back to your original question, who bought the treasury? Now, part two of the answer is, so my point there is, let me back up. If a bank bought it, then maybe it could be money printing if you're defining that by increasing the amount of dollars circulating chasing goods and services. Okay, now that said, are government salaries inflationary? In a way, I would argue they are, because the government doesn't produce any goods and services. So if you're giving purchasing power to people who aren't producing goods and services, then you're increasing your potential. That could be inflationary. So I don't know if I would say that's technical money printing, but you see where I'm going with that. You're giving a large amount of purchasing power. So the more and more purchasing power you give to people that aren't producing stuff, and the more stuff they consume, that could lead to higher prices. But unfortunately, on the same token, it's going to lead to a lot of, it could be deflationary as well, because it could put a lot of businesses out of business. And it just depends. But the bottom line there is that the more government salaries you have, the less economic activity you will have and the less dynamic your economy will be. I mean, we just go back to a very simple way of thinking about this is going back to 1912 prior to something called the Federal Reserve. And if you go back to 1912, you can see government spending in total, meaning federal, state, local, was maybe 6, 7, 8% of GDP. So said another way, the private sector accounted for 93% of GDP, economic output. Compare that to today, where that number went from 93% to maybe 45%, maybe 50%. So which economy would be more dynamic? The one where 93% of the output was produced by the private sector, or the one where 50% of the output or the economic activity is from government spending? So that's the main takeaway here, is regardless of whether it is money printing, depends how you define it, depends what's going on, who's buying the treasuries, et cetera. Could it be inflationary? Sure. But it's the bottom line is whatever it is, it makes us less economic, it makes society less economically efficient, I think is probably the best way to say it. All right, guys, I'm going to go ahead and leave it there, get some rest, and I've got to do a Rebel Capital's Pro live stream here at about 20 minutes. So on that note, if you haven't checked out Rebel Capitalist Pro, did I say live? I don't know what the hell's going on, guys. my head is just spinning. What I meant to say, regardless of what I said, was check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. It's the online investment community that I have with my good friends Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh, and we got pros in there like Brent Johnson and Jason Hartman and Patrick Serezna And I think Jason Burrick is going to get on there Monday and talk with the members. So we've always got people like that. And it's got some incredible research from Chris and Lynn as well. So check that out at georgegammon.com/pro. Hopefully I got that right. Let me do some shout outs here. All right. We got Bull Dag in the house. Cabra Gone, Cabulous, J Doe, Jane, Joe Time, UKRR, Roger Rose, DQ Winters, GH, Edward Diaz, 1130, Rafael Sanchez, Raven Mad. Who else do we have? Felicia Muhammad, Scott Fitzpatrick, Malaysia Numismatic, Alex Castillo, Wayne Smith, Market Mania in the house, Aristo, Carlos Garcia. Oh, you know what? That reminds me, I'm reading off all these Spanish names. Guys, we just set up a new YouTube channel, and it's called George Gammon in Espanol. So what we're going to be doing is we're taking all the whiteboard videos, and I'm having a Spanish speaker dub my words. So it'll be me doing the whiteboard, but the talking will sound like Spanish. It'll be like watching an old Bruce Lee movie where the old karate movie where the words don't match up with the lips or, you know, with what the mouth is saying. So it'll be something like that, but it'll be a fun kind of experiment. So if you're a native Spanish speaker and you'd rather listen to the whiteboards in Spanish instead of my horrible chopped up English, you can check out the new YouTube channel, George Gammon in Espanol. All right, guys, enjoy the rest of your evening, and I will see you on the next video. Make sure that you're always standing up for freedom, liberty, and free market capitalism.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.